Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Mark Lee Gardner about his book, To Hell on a Fast Horse, Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett, and the Epic Chase to Justice in the Old West. I'm very happy now to welcome Mark Singleton. He teaches at St. John's College here in Santa Fe, and he's the author of the new book, Yoga Body, The Origins of Modern Posture Practice. He will be speaking at Spandorama Yoga Studio this coming Friday, the 19th of February at 5:30. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a fascinating and scholarly book about yoga, and it looks at yoga the way we practice it today and puts it in a context that's really quite surprising. Let's go for a moment back to what the early texts say about yoga, and specifically hatha yoga. What do these words mean, hatha and yoga?
Well, yoga is a word that's been around for a very, very long time. Even, let's say, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, you start to have the term used in classical texts like the Upanishads. And the range of meanings that the word has had from that time until today is enormous. I mean, there's an assumption that yoga means a single thing, and if we could just find it, you know, we could draw a circle around it and say, this is yoga. But through the millennia, and especially into the modern age, the meaning of the word has changed so much as to be unrecognizable, that, you know, sometimes the forms are so different from each other that you can't really tell whether you're still talking about the same thing. So the Sanskrit root of the word is yuj, which means to yoke, and it gives us the word yoke. And it simply means to join. So, and there's various interpretations of that. Sometimes, most commonly, it's interpreted to mean the yoking of the individual soul with the greater soul, with the Atman, and the Brahman, the greater soul. And then one of the most important developments came about in the medieval period, and that came to be known as Hatha Yoga, the yoga of force, forceful yoga. And it involved a lot more formal use of the body. So doing things like certain postures that you would hold, and a lot of pranayama, which is the breathing techniques, as well as kind of a system that you might call pneumatics, which would be squeezing the airs, the vital airs in the body, the prana, and directing it physically to a spiritual end, which would be the raising of the kundalini energy, which is thought to reside at the base of the spine. And so these systems flourished often within the context of tantra, which is another, you know, word which has an enormous range of meanings. But loosely, we could say that tantra is kind of yoking the body towards spiritual ends. And then later on, these traditions tend to die out. There's not much of a practice tradition that can be traced within Hatha Yoga or these older yoga traditions. And then in the modern period, we start to get this immense revival.
Hang on, before we go to the revival, who was practicing these? Was it the domain of monks?
Well, if we address the Hatha Yoga tradition first, it seems like these practitioners were actually outside the ritual, the caste domain of Hinduism. So you would have, you know, the four main castes, starting with the Brahmins and going down through the Shudras, who were the lowest caste, and tended to be workers doing the kind of jobs that other people didn't want to do. And you have this phenomenon in Hatha Yoga that you step outside the kind of pure ritual space of Hinduism into a place where it seems like everybody was welcome regardless of caste, and oftentimes regardless of religion. So you would have Muslims mixing with so-called Hindus and sort of, you know, sharing a guru. And the demographics are kind of difficult to see. There's been quite a lot of recent work on that, but there was also a tradition of these Hatha yogins engaging in, what should we say, trade soldiering. So they were they controlled the trade routes across northern India, and would often also get in conflict with the East India Company and later the British Raj, and disrupt their control of the region. And this was linked to, or this trade soldiering was linked to magic. that they had acquired through Hatha Yoga. And that's another, that's something that I didn't mention before, that to do yoga in common parlance often meant to practice magic and to be able to bring down curses or blessings on people. And so these yogins were often bankrolled by kings.
So not sleight of hand magic, but actual curses and purifications and things like that.
All of that. In the late modern period, in the 18th century, sort of towards the end of the 18th century, these yogins were outlawed by the British authorities because, well, one they disrupted these trade routes, but for another thing, that they were associated with a kind of perverse, anti-Christian, satanic behavior. And so they were shut down. And as a result, since they couldn't practice the trade soldiering anymore, they moved increasingly into urban areas, and they would perform. So they would perform magic tricks. So, you know, the guy with the flute and the cobra would be colloquially termed a yogi. You know, the guy lying on the bed of nails, or the guy contorted into, you know, a horrific posture, collecting money, because that's how they made their livelihood, would have been called a yogi. So you started to have all these associations, this changing association of yoga with, on the one hand, you know, violent kind of soldiers, I guess, mercenaries, and then later on with these kind of panhandling showmen who would turn up at festivals and would be, you know, more and more a fixture of urban life in India.
Now, these people who you're talking about, who were lying on beds of nails and who were showmen and so on, were written about by outsiders as Europeans began to visit and the whole colonial period was happening. What kinds of observations were visitors, Europeans, making?
Yeah, this started in the 17th century, very, very early on, and lots of the accounts that you can read are quite similar. They must have been reading each other or all going to the same place. And what they would find is, one of the kind of stock descriptions is these emaciated, kind of revolting-looking men with nails that have grown out of their fingers and pierced their wrists. You know, that kind of horrific display that later became a kind of, you know, a stock component of ethnography, and people back in their drawing rooms in Europe would read through and look at these look at sketches of these people. They were also associated with a kind of malevolence, so you wouldn't want to be around them very much. And this comes through in stories that you read in things like the Strand magazine of, you know, these evil people. And Strand magazine, I'm talking several hundred years later, but that process started with these early ethnographers in the 17th century. And it also comes out in film. So whenever in a black and white film there's a character who is a yogi, they're always, you know, they have the evil eye, and Europeans are always being cursed by them and killed by them. So that's what happens early on in there.
Was there an acknowledgement of the spiritual practice of yoga?
Yes. There was an immense amount of interest in India from the 18th century onwards, especially when it was discovered that Sanskrit was linked to Latin and Greek and linked to the Romance languages, and that somehow the European heritage went all the way back to India. So there was an explosion of interest in what was happening in India, and of course it was a trade hub. It was the jewel in the empire, jewel in the crown. And people went there, and from time to time you get accounts of Europeans, a lot of British people kind of going native, finding what they believe to be a truth that isn't possible back in England, and a real interest in what they're doing and how this relates to Christianity. And at the same time you have the emergence of the study of religion, of comparative religion, which before it hadn't really occurred to anybody to do that. But suddenly, you know, we're in Europe, is in China, is in India, seeing all these different things that look like, you know, in some form of what they do back home, but are slightly different. So people started to get fascinated by that. And usually, well, there's various stages. There was a kind of sympathy initially to what people were doing there, and a real urge to understand what people were doing from a from a Christian perspective. They didn't have any other perspective. And then with the age of missionaries, that started to change. It was much more a question of using the beliefs that they already found there in order to convert people to Christianity. And then later on, the third stage is the Western esotericists, the people who are interested in the occult and who think that religion isn't specifically linked to Christianity and that it's valid in India and in China as it is back home. And they start to really incorporate that and to disseminate it to a wider public.
We're talking to Mark Singleton about his book, Yoga Body, The Origins of Modern Posture Practice. So around the late 19th century and through the mid-20th century, well, and really to this day, but you have the rise of physical culture, things like gymnastics and bodybuilding that took off in Europe. And they were associated, I thought this was fascinating, they were associated in England with something that was called muscular Christianity. That's and right. Became popularized through the YMCA. Tell us about this whole phenomenon.
So muscular Christianity was a movement to build better bodies in the service of empire. So this was a period of great expansion. Britain was no longer tied to, was no longer confined by a sea. They started to move out across the globe, as far as India, as far as China. And the sense was that we had the answer, the British had the answer to the ills of the rest of the world, to the uncivilized nature of most of the world. And so muscular Christianity was very much caught up with this colonial project and with this the missionary project. And the basic idea was that to build better bodies, bodies that were healthier, that were stronger, and that could dominate, so could impose beliefs, that could impose a certain way of life on those not fortunate enough yet to have received that message or to have had that upbringing. That to have these bigger, better bodies would be in the interests of the empire and of God, of the Holy Empire, I guess.
And so what did that look like? I mean, the kind of bodybuilding that culminated in the stuff that you see on the front of those crazy bodybuilding magazines?
Yeah, but these terms, bodybuilding and gymnastics, were a lot looser back then than they are now. So, in fact, what was happening at the beginning of this movement was something more like calisthenics. And it stemmed from a Swede called P.H. Ling, who created this system of calisthenics, of he called it gymnastics. And this became, this was exported very quickly across Europe, and there were other variations, especially in France, but it was adopted by the British and became the standard training, the standard physical training for army and navy often. And then you had other developments of this, such as a Danish system called primitive gymnastics, which is quite important to the account that I give in my book, that involves that's a lot more rigorous, that's a lot more dynamic, and which involves a lot more of the movement that you'd associate with the gymnastics these days, whereas Ling you might not recognize. And alongside that, there was the dawn of weight resistance exercise, especially in Sandow's work. He was an early popularizer of that. And one of the most important tours that he did was to India and to the East, where he was received like a saint, or he was already a hero there for showing the Indians a way to build their own bodies as a kind of counter to the dominance of the colonial presence. So you had this strange turnaround where these methods that were being taught by the colonial authorities in India were then taken and kind of used, often secretly, by by the Indians as a kind of revolutionary tool.
And one thing that was so interesting about this back and forth influence is that part of the colonial influence in India was this stereotype that the Indian people were decadent and degenerate, and there were shades of social Darwinism and all of that. And they used this bodybuilding movement and combined it with their own yoga culture and made something, I guess, something new of it.
That's right. Well, The term yoga at that stage, at that moment in time that you're talking about, started to be used as a synonym for these bodybuilding techniques and for this kind of gymnastics. And that was drawing on exercise traditions that had been present and that were present, if you know, very weak in India at the time. Drawing on those, such as wrestling, such as some physical weight resistance with using poles and barbells, I guess, and also a martial tradition that had been there, but which was not part of yoga as such, yoga as we would think of it as a spiritual tradition.
But all of those native to India.
All of those native to India. That's right. And then you had this enormous influx of Western style gymnastics, and these were taught in Indian schools. They were they were standard forms of gymnastics that every school child would have known, and that they were propagated by organizations like you say, the YMCA. And so along with this came a rise in nationalist consciousness that Hindu Indians were oppressed. They had been oppressed, so the story goes, by Muslims for hundreds of years, and now they were being oppressed by the British colonists. And so physical culture, whether from India or imported, was a vital tool, which they then took, and they put these two things together in various combinations and often called them yoga. So you would have people like one of the people that I talk about in the book is Sri Raghavendra Rao, also known as Tiruka, who traveled around the country posing as a yoga guru, so posing as somebody who would teach this classical yoga of the breath and of meditation, but actually teaching these martial techniques to thousands of people, if we believe his account, all over rural India, preparing them for this violent uprising against the British. And there's other associations as well with, let's say, in the accounts that we hear of the freedom struggle, it's often the Gandhian peaceful, non-violent approach that's foregrounded. So, we think that India came to independence free of violence, free of the turmoil that we might associate with revolution in other contexts. But there was actually a large part of the population preparing themselves for a violent struggle, and you would have they were labeled terrorists. You would have people running around with bombs, throwing them at British government offices, things like that. And so yoga was from very early on kind of drawn into this nationalist project to liberate, in a kind of non-spiritual political sense, liberate the Indian people from colonial rule.
Which is a far cry from what you learn when you go to a nice yoga studio in Santa Fe and lie down on your mat.
That's right. Yeah. So things have changed. Things have changed a lot. And there's not a single explanation for why one does yoga in this way today in Santa Fe. But there's a couple of very important tributaries, I'd say. One of them is that kind of fighting martial tradition, which I think you still see in systems like Ashtanga yoga, which are a very, very physical and require an awful lot of effort. And on the other side, you have a thing which now has tended to become known as Hatha yoga, referring, of course, back to the medieval Hatha yoga, which we talked about earlier, but which now tends to connote relaxation and gentle stretching and a little bit of breathing, but yeah, much more like the kind of thing that you describe. And that also has its roots round about the same time in the occult circles that I was talking about earlier in the West, in Europe and America. And this is a movement that I call harmonial gymnastics, which is very different to the kind of martial gymnastics that we were just talking about, and which looks very, very much like the kind of stretch and relax yoga that you see everywhere in the UK and in Europe today. And it was really based on the idea, which you know, seems natural enough, I think now, it's, you know, it sounds like what most people would think of as yoga, that you use the body to access a kind of spiritual realm through things like stretching, through things like deep breathing, and through certain kinds of relaxation.
So you have, to oversimplify, peaceful yoga and warrior yoga.
You could simplify it even further, and this wouldn't be to do justice to the complexity of the picture, but you could simplify that to masculine and feminine. The vast majority of the people that were traveling around India as clandestine fighting yogis were men. The vast majority of the people working within these esoteric spiritual gymnastic traditions in Europe and America were women. And I don't think it's any coincidence that those two poles of yoga tend to draw either predominantly men or predominantly women still today.
One of the things that's so fascinating about your book is that it shows that, in a way, it reminded me of music. You know, you have the music that starts in Africa and then it influences music in the Caribbean and then that goes back. You have this back and forth cross-pollination of these traditions. And in a way, I mean, the origins can quickly get lost. Now, I haven't practiced all that much yoga, but I've practiced from time to time, and you go to a class and you get the feeling that what you're learning goes millennia back to a pure Sanskrit tradition that yogis have been practicing ever since. But in fact, there are these roots in England and in Swedish gymnastics, which is probably what makes it so popular here in the first place, is that it does have Western cultural roots, this yoga that we practice, these asanas in our studios.
Yeah, that's right. And in a sense, it's true that yoga dates back a long time. I mean, that's perfectly true. But if I tend to emphasize the discontinuities in the book and in our conversation today, it's not quite so simple as that. It does date back that far. And there are precedents, and there are almost always, you know, elements of tradition within modernity. But it's that back and forth, I think, that's the most fascinating. And it's not something that you're likely to hear in a yoga class, where that ancientness is emphasized as a kind of badge. It's something that assures the authenticity of a system. And if you can't say that it goes back that far, if you can't trace its lineage, then somehow the whole system is in doubt. And I guess it's easy to do that. I'm not the first person who's noticed that there's a discrepancy between the so-called classical procedures of yoga, or so-called classical yoga, and what we do today. It's been known about for a long time. All you have to do is pick up one of those medieval texts or one of those texts that goes back further and flick through it and look at what you do in a yoga class to see that, well, things have changed drastically. But I'd say there's three ways to take that. The news, let's say, that yoga isn't necessarily ancient. One is to dismiss everything that you see in a yoga studio in America or in, you know, wherever it might be in the globalized world, and say, well, it's not authentic because it isn't what it says it is. The other is to just reject the findings out of hand, and I get a lot of both of these, you know, to say, well, there's no such thing as modern yoga. There's a continuity, and these findings are, they have no particular relevance to the practice that I do and to the lineage that I'm in, and therefore I'm not going to discuss them with you. So those are the two most common, and these two camps tend to fight it out quite a lot and to get nowhere. I mean, I think ultimately it's a fruitless conversation. The evidence is so clear and so abundant now that I think that the conversation about what people are doing as yoga has to move to a different level, where you're not just bickering about whether it's old or whether it's not. And so I think that the first thing that has to change, if we're to sort of, you know, move beyond that fruitless debate, is to know that there is no such thing as yoga, that there is no single yoga, and that we'd be better served by thinking about yogas. And even more than that, by thinking about yoga and its various instantiations, thinking of the term as a homonym. So an example of a homonym would be, you know, pole and pole. There's no pole standing at the North Pole because they're different kinds of poles. And in the same way, there's no single yoga. There's the yoga that appears in texts like the Bhagavad Gita. There's the yoga of Patanjali. There's the yoga of Shaiva Tantras. And those yogas are different in themselves, and they're also different from what we might call modern yoga. Some people object, well, yeah, of course, okay, fine. Yoga has always been changing. It's always been a dynamic tradition. It's never been one thing that you can identify and that stops growing, and that's what makes yoga alive. And I agree with that, but it doesn't take into account the kind of sea change that yoga underwent during the modern period. So, you know, the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. And so that's, I think, what we have to address if we're going to go on and, you know, have a serious conversation about what it is that people are doing as yoga these days.
And it may not be important for some people to know what the roots of the practice are that they're doing. They may find that doing these asanas and doing these movements helps their lives and makes them happy and so on. But I think there is something to be said for not misrepresenting your roots.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also something to be said for, the negative side of that would be, okay, well, we don't want you believing that, you know, what you're doing comes from ancient India, because that's historically not valid, and you can't believe that anymore. That'd kind of be, you know, the negative side of things, which doesn't portray the whole story, because as I said, you know, there is this influence, there is this back and forth. It's not simply that it was made up by Europeans or something like that. But the other side of the story is that within these traditions that I've been talking about, particularly to take the example of homonial gymnastics, these are the kinds of practices that our great grandmothers, great great grandfathers would have been doing often. You know, it was more localized than yoga is today, but it's the kind of thing that they would have been doing 100 years ago, 80 years ago, even much more recently than that. And this, I think the easy way out of this, a wrong way to see it would be to think that this is just gymnastics, that this is somehow a denigration of the value of this practice, which is so dear to so many people. But actually what was happening was something like a homegrown yoga tradition, which was called gymnastics, but which, as I've said, looks very much like yoga. And I'm sure if one of those classes was, you know, from the 1920s, was transported forwards and, you know, you could attend it here in Santa Fe, you wouldn't see that much difference between that and the yoga that's taught here. And I think there's a great deal of value in recognizing where one comes from in terms of practice, rather than thinking this is from thousands of miles away, it's oriental and therefore, you know, alluring or something like that. But actually there is a whole tradition of spirituality in America that has informed these practices that people do, and that needs to be looked at, and that needs to be somehow assimilated or rejected, depending on what one's preference is, but that certainly needs to be acknowledged.
We're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you, are you a yoga practitioner yourself? Is that how you got into this whole subject?
That's right, yeah, yeah. I've been practicing for about 15 years, and the way this project came about was that, I'd been practicing predominantly asana, which is the postures of yoga, for quite a number of years, and then started to read these older texts and saw, you know, the kind of discrepancy that kind of leaps out of the pages at you. Yeah, I still practice. My practice has changed over the course of the years and over the course of this research, and I think I have a slightly different take on things now. But yeah, I consider myself a practitioner of yoga, for sure.
Mark Singleton is author of the book Yoga Body, The Origins of Modern Posture Practice, and he will be speaking at Spandarama Yoga this Friday at 5:30, Friday the 19th of February. Spandarama Yoga Studio is on Early Street in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Mark Lee Gardner. He is the author of the new book, To Hell on a Fast Horse, Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett, and the epic chase to justice in the Old West. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be a part of it today with you.
And we're looking forward to your being here in Santa Fe, and we'll tell people about your events in just a couple of minutes. But first, let's talk about this book. This is the first historical account that examines together the lives of Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett. How did you get interested in the subject and decide to write about both of them?
Well, I'll tell you, it actually started out, my interest was in Pat Garrett, and I was fascinated, you know, by his life, especially the years after he killed Billy the Kid. He had all kinds of ups and downs, and he was murdered in 1908, which a lot of people don't know about. But then it morphed into this dual biography, and it was really a suggestion from my agent. He said, you know, what about both of them together? And then the more I thought about it, I thought, yeah, it's a brilliant idea because, you know, they're really one of the few classic duos in American history where they made each other. There'd be no Billy the Kid without Pat Garrett, and there'd be no Pat Garrett without Billy the Kid.
Let's talk about each one of them. And, of course, Billy the Kid is sort of the beloved, what would you call him, sort of anti-hero. He was an Anglo guy. He spoke, as you say, spoke Spanish and rode like an Apache.
Yes.
How did he, and he died very young. How did he become who he was? What was his early life like?
Well, you know, he started out, I think, a lot like any other normal, typical young American boy in the 19th century. He was born just before the Civil War erupted. He may have lost his father in the Civil War, who, you know, he may have been a, we don't really know, he may have been a Civil War soldier in an Indiana regiment, but he ended up growing up like lots of other boys in a household, you know, operated by a single mom, you know, a single mom, and he had a brother, and eventually they, like a lot of Americans after the Civil War, head out west, and first they're Wichita, then Denver, then Santa Fe, and they end up in Silver City, and his mother dies when he's about 15, and Billy's kind of on his own, and he was actually on his own a little before then because his mother suffered from tuberculosis. His stepfather wasn't real interested in them. And when you're on your own, the places that, you know, they're fun to hang out in are the saloons and gambling houses, and he starts, you know, hanging out with the wrong crowd.
And where does his life go from there? How does he survive?
Well, he survives just what you mentioned before. I mean, he learns to survive Old West style. He learns New Mexican Spanish fluently. He learns how to play poker in Spanish Monte. He learns how to operate a six-shooter. He kills his first man in Arizona in a basically a barroom scuffle, saloon scuffle, flees back to New Mexico and gets involved in the Lincoln County War. And his friend, one of his really a good friend and employer, John Henry Tunstall, when he's murdered in the Lincoln County War, Billy swears revenge. And Billy's a very vindictive lad, and he gets that revenge a few times before everything's said and done.
What was New Mexico, and specifically Lincoln County, what were they like in that period post-Civil War?
Well, it was pretty much up for, I guess the phrase, up for grabs. And I mean that in not just in a sense of land or settlement, but economically it was up for grabs. And there was one controlling faction called the House that controlled the economic and the business of this huge county, which was the largest in the United States at that time. And John Henry Tunstall and his partner, Alexander McSween, were going to be competitors with the House. And basically, it turned violent. They started killing one another in order to keep, you know, to see who's going to be the leader or at least the main business operation in Lincoln County. And Billy gets swept up in that.
And he, as you say, he was a cattle rustler. He was an outlaw. How did he become so well known and so well loved?
Well, that's the fascinating thing I found out about Billy the Kid. I was really surprised as I got into it at how well loved he was, especially by the native New Mexican population. And you know, he is picked up by the newspapers, and especially towards the end of his career when he makes his brazen daylight escape and kills his two guards from the Lincoln County Jail. But the thing was is that he had this amazing personality. He had charisma. He was a natural-born leader of sorts, and he made a good story. I mean, he's this you know, very young kid. In fact, when he's killed, he's 21, and there was the legend that, you know, he had killed a man for each year of his life. That wasn't true. But you know, there was a certain yellow journalism popularity there with this idea of Billy the Kid, the outlaw that nobody could stop. And then there was the real-life thing where he was actually, you know, beloved as an individual by those who were close to him, again, by his friends and by the native New Mexican population. I think part of that is that, you know, he was embarrassing the sheriffs and the gringo posses and judges that, you know, weren't really being very sympathetic to the native population at that time.
We're talking to Mark Lee Gardner about his book, To Hell on a Fast Horse. Now let's talk about Pat Garrett. He was originally from Alabama. How did he find his way to New Mexico?
Well, as I say in the book, he got to New Mexico in a roundabout way, just like Billy the Kid. He was born in Alabama to a southern planter, and they ended up moving around. They settled before the war, a civil war, in Louisiana. And Pat Garrett's father is probably the most prominent planter, the most prominent citizen of Claiborne Parish. He built the courthouse for the parish. But the Civil War ruined everything for that family. I mean, Pat Garrett had basically a privileged existence growing up, and that was all gone with the war. They lost all their property, and Pat Garrett strikes out west and first ends up in Texas, becomes a buffalo hunter, and then after he helps exterminate all the bison, he shows up at Fort Sumner and becomes a fixture there.
What was Billy the Kid first arrested for that he was, well, what was he arrested for which he was sentenced to death before he escaped?
Well, that was the famous murder trial with for the death of Sheriff James, or, I'm sorry, Sheriff William Brady during the Lincoln County War. And Billy was, you know, it's interesting, Billy wasn't the only one that was took a hand in that killing. There were several regulators that fired you know, across the street at Brady and his deputies. And there were, Billy was indicted for the murder as well as three others. But Billy is the only one that ends up being tried and convicted of the crime. And that's what he is... And that's what he most feared originally, and he tried to get a pardon through Governor Lew Wallace. Actually, you know, he held up his end of the bargain to get that pardon, and Governor Wallace didn't. But when the pardon doesn't come through and Pat Garrett gets elected, you know, with the promise he's going to put a stop to the outlaw ways of Billy the Kid, then Pat Garrett, you know, takes him and gets him locked up. He's taken to trial, and then he ends up back in Lincoln County where he's under Garrett's care until his breakout in April of 1881.
And then a manhunt ensues.
Yes. Yeah, you know, it's Pat Garrett was, of all things, he was determined. He was dogged. And if he promised to do something, he would do it at great risk to himself. I mean, danger was not something that affected him. Now, he admitted that there were many times when he was scared. He could get scared just like anybody else, but that wasn't going to stop him from pursuing and capturing Billy the Kid. And he actually, I think this is really amazing, he's elected in November of 1880, so he's not officially the county sheriff until January of 1881, but he doesn't wait. You know, he's made this promise, and he's raring to go out there after Billy the Kid, so the sheriff that's currently in charge makes Garrett a deputy and says, go for it. And Garrett and his posses surround Billy the Kid at Stinking Spring, which is just east of Fort Sumner, and in December of 1880, they capture the famous Billy the Kid, which makes national headlines.
And what happened after that?
Well, that's when we talk about the trial. I mean, Garrett gets Billy to jail, and Billy is transported to Mesilla, where the murder trial takes place. Billy is then transported back to Garrett's care, and he's supposed to be executed by hanging on Friday, the unlucky day, Friday, May 13th, in Lincoln. But before that can happen, in April, Garrett is away from town collecting taxes. That was the job of county sheriff's that time, was to collect the county taxes, and he's under the care of two guards. One's Bob Ollinger, who did not like Billy, and Billy did not like him, and Bob Ollinger was accurately portrayed, has been accurately portrayed as a bully, he was, and then James Bell, who Billy the Kid somewhat liked. And while Ollinger is across the street feeding the other prisoners from the courthouse jail, Billy is able to surprise Bell and kills him. And Bob Ollinger hears the gunshot, runs across the street, and right underneath Billy's window, the jail cell on the second floor, Billy yells down, "Hello, Bob," and gives him two loads from his 10-gauge shotgun.
But Billy the Kid, not too long after that, winds up on the wrong end of a gun, although he does hide out pretty well for a while.
Yeah, he does. And, you know, Garrett was criticized for the way Garrett seemed to be slow in getting after the Kid right after those two deputies were murdered. And, you know, Garrett was taking his time. If Billy was in the territory, he wanted him to get comfortable. He wanted to slip in there unawares when Billy was least expecting it. You know, we wanted Billy to get comfortable, and that's indeed what happens. And Garrett arrives at Fort Sumner with only two deputies. He didn't take a giant old posse because there were so many kid sympathizers that too many men know the word could get out and Billy would be gone. So he takes two trusted deputies, that's all he has with him, and arrives at Fort Sumner on July 14, 1881. He sends in John Poe first to kind of get the lay of the land and see if he can hear anything. And Poe notices how suspicious everyone is, and Poe has his own suspicions that the kid is around. And they later, all three, come back about midnight or a little before midnight, and Pat Garrett is in Pete Maxwell's bedroom at Fort Sumner, you know, the famous confrontation that has been filmed a gazillion times. And while Garrett is talking to Maxwell, Billy shows up at the Maxwell house, and he sees the two deputies, and he panics. You know, he doesn't know who these strangers are, and he starts shouting, "Keyness, Keyness, you know, who is it?" He jumps up on the porch, races into Maxwell's bedroom, and he approaches the bed, sees the shadowy figure next to Maxwell, and he jumps back, raises his gun. And again, you know, Billy had some humanity. I mean, you know, he didn't just shoot right away because he didn't know who these people were. They might have been a friend of Maxwell. But that humanity of Billy, that hesitation, cost him his life. As Pat Garrett recognizes his voice, pulls his revolver and shoots one shot, hits Billy in the chest. It's a mortal wound. Garrett fires another shot as he's racing out of the room, and so is Pete Maxwell. And as Garrett gets outside the building, John Poe is up there with his gun, and he gets ready to point his gun at Maxwell, and Garrett says, "Don't shoot Pete," you know, and he says, I came on the kid in there, and I think I've got him." And he, sure enough, he got Billy the Kid.
So after that, Pat Garrett was a hero for having vanquished Billy the Kid, but soon after that, there was other kinds of talk, and he was considered not so much of a hero, to the point where he actually wrote a book in his own defense of the account.
Yes, that's correct. You know, it's one of the sad, I think it's a tragedy, what happens to Pat Garrett, because initially he is hailed in the press. I mean, this makes international headlines when he kills Billy the Kid. And, you know, most New Mexicans who did not know Billy, you know, and all they read was what was in the papers, you know, they thought Billy the Kid was this heinous serial killer, and they were so relieved that he was no longer on the face of the earth, and they celebrated Garrett. They threw money at Garrett. I mean, they gave him all, you know, beyond the reward promised by the territory, people, you know, put together funds to give Garrett money. But as time went on, there were the whispers, you know, as to how Billy was killed, and some said, "Oh, Billy didn't have a gun," and others were upset because Garrett didn't give Billy a chance to kill him, you know, like the sheriff. "Okay, Billy, you get the shot first, and then after you shoot, then I'm going to try to kill you." But as you know, Garrett knew that once Billy killed the two guards, that when they met again, it was going to be either Garrett or the Kid. But nevertheless, over time, Billy's stature grows. He becomes the Robin Hood of the Southwest, especially in the 20th century with all these films and the popular stories about Billy the Kid. And if you've got a hero in your outlaw, well, the man that kills that hero, you know, he's going to become the villain. And that's what happens to Pat Garrett. The tragedy that I refer to is that it happened within Garrett's own lifetime.
Well, you pointed to places where he'd been held up alongside John Wilkes Booth and Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes, I mean, I found that, you know, fairly outrageous that Pat Garrett is in a book called The Book of Assassins, along with men who killed, you know, our beloved presidents. And, you know, he was a duly elected county sheriff, and he risked his life as a county sheriff to stop Billy the Kid. Nobody else had been willing to do that. And you know, and again, the tragedy is that in his later years, he's cast aside. When he has financial troubles and political troubles, they don't need Pat Garrett all of a sudden, you know. They needed him at one point when he was the man for the job, but they don't remember that at the end of his life when he could use the territory's help.
Now, the book reads it's a very vivid account of this whole story and goes on beyond the death of Billy the Kid. How did you recreate all of this? I mean, there's so much sorting out I would think you have to do between fact and legend.
Oh, well, yes. Well, thanks. I mean, it was meant to be a vivid account, and you're exactly right. That was probably the most challenging aspect of writing this book, was that there are so many episodes that involve Billy the Kid where you have completely contradictory accounts as to what happened. And what I tried to do was, you know, looking at all the evidence, and I picked the scenario or episode or account, the firsthand account, that I felt was the most accurate and went with that. But in the notes in the back of the book, I explained that, you know, these are other possibilities This is why I went with the version that's in the book, but these are other possibilities as to what happened. I didn't really put much credence sometimes in the other possibilities, but I felt like, you know, if a person is, you know, gets excited after reading this story and they want to pursue it and get into it in depth, you know, the sources are there, and they can go to them and make a decision for themselves.
Now, you are, among many other things, a musician, and we're going to hear a song that you are performing that you wrote in a moment about Billy the Kid, but tell us about the musical part of your life.
Sure. Well, you know, I've always been interested in history, but as a young man, I've always been interested in Americana music or roots music, and I picked up the banjo when I was in college, and my first summer jobs were with the National Park Service, and I took my five-string bluegrass banjo to work at Bent's Fort in southern Colorado. That's 1846 is the year they represent, and I quickly discovered that the music of Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys was not what they were playing on the frontier in the 1840s, and that really got me excited, so that I had kind of these dual paths. As I got deeper into working as a professional historian, I also studied the historic music of America's past, and to the point where, you know, I wanted the vintage instruments, I wanted to play the same styles that were played historically, and that's what I do today. I travel, you know, around the country with a guy named Rex Rideout, who plays fiddle and mandolin and all kinds of stuff, and we present the music of the American West as it was played, you know, during the 19th century and early 20th century parts of American history.
Now, you, Mark Lee Gardner, will be here on Thursday, the 25th of February at the Santuario de Guadalupe at 7 in the evening, and you'll be doing a performance called Billy the Kid in Story and Song. That's part of Las Golondrinas lecture series, so we'll get to hear your music at that event.
Yes, and what that's going to be is I'm going to perform songs that were associated with Billy, things that we know that he liked that, from accounts that were left by fellow regulators and others. So we'll hear songs that we know Billy the Kid danced to at New Mexican Bailes. And then the second part of the program is going to be, you know, the legend, the songs that were written about Billy the Kid, you know, even stuff, you know, by Bob Dylan, because he wrote the soundtrack for the Sam Peckinpah film, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid from 1973.
And you'll be at the Fray Angelico Chavez Library at noon the next day, Friday the 26th of February. Both of those are free events. Mark Lee Gardner is the author of the book To Hell on a Fast Horse, Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett, and the Epic Chase to Justice in the Old West. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. I hope to see you there when I'm out there.
Absolutely.
Oh, that finger of Billy the Kid, what a heap of harm it did. But when Billy died, the finger died too, and was buried beneath the morning dew. No more to pull his six-gun true, the finger of Billy the Kid. But one day up Chicago way, I heard a sideshow feller say, just step this way and for a dime you'll see the trigger finger of Kid Billy. What has pulled 100 massacres, the finger of Billy the Kid. Well, I knew that feller, he lied like a snake, and that his finger was a fake. But I paid my dime to see the show, for I was a friend of Billy's. I'll have you know, he did me a favor in New Mexico. The outlaw Billy the Kid. I followed the crowd into the hall, saw the finger preserved in Alki Hall. Then I pulled my gun so none could tell, and I blowed that thing clar into hell, and gave a yip and a mighty yell, hurrah for Billy the Kid. Of course they threw me into jail, from where a letter I did mail to Sheriff Pat Garrett, who killed the kid. And I told him what I'd gone and did, and to tell me quick if he got rid of the finger of Billy the Kid. Well, old Pat came back quick and hot, and in a few words he said a lot. The trigger finger of young Billy is still upon his dead body. I know because I dug to see the finger of Billy the Kid. If Billy Billy can hear from his Dolby shack. I reckon he knows I paid him back for the favor he did me when my voice was stilled by thirst and hunger, and my body he filled with buffalo meat that had been killed by the finger of Billy the Kid. Thank you. We'll see you in a few minutes.